This is workshop two of the DGHA 2014 convention. Speaker is Paul Adrian, Manager, Guide Dog Services, Victorian Guide Dogs. Paul speaks to us about, gives us an overview of dog guide training and finishing up with clicker training for guide dogs.
This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Which is a bit of a milestone, and it is actually really interesting to look at the people that you work with in the organisations. So many of the staff within our organisations have really fantastic longevity. Harry is an example of that great longevity within the industry, and there are other instructors around Australia who have completed more than 50 years in their job role. So I think that's pretty fabulous and shows that the commitment that the individuals who work within these dog guide organisations have, and how much we enjoy the jobs that we do. But I want to talk a little bit about how I learned to train dogs. And that was 30 years ago. It was a different environment, a different world. And I learned from some absolutely fabulous mentors. Some of you may know the name Eric Hatchley, some of you may know the name Keith Holdsworth. They were pioneers of the guide dog movement in Australia. They also loved dogs. They were really kind to dogs. They taught me methods back then that I would not use today. They were not bad methods at the time, but I would choose differently now based on changes in public perception, greater knowledge, the use of science to underpin my activities today. At that time, I trained exclusively with a check collar, and I would argue strongly at that time it was necessary. I wouldn't argue that today at all. People might choose to use a check collar. I don't find we generally have a need for it today. I'm not making people wrong. I'm just saying that's the journey that I've been on. At that stage, also, very, very little food reward was used in the training of dogs. It was almost frowned upon. So I don't know how long people's history of working guide dogs is in this room. So actually, I might just do a bit of a check around the room. Can I just get a show of hands, and I'll give some feedback on this, for people who've been using a dog guide less than 5 years? So that's a good half dozen. Between 5 and 10 years, and we'll get another good half dozen. Between 10 and 20 years, another half dozen. More than 20 years, two. So plenty of experience there in this room, and while we've got 25 or so dogs here, your experiences with dogs, given the length that people have been using dogs, must be in the vicinity of 100 or more dogs. So within this room, we know a little bit about dogs. So as I mentioned, I was trying to use a check collar. I was even trying to use a double-handed correction on dogs, a bit feisty. And I would have argued at the time that was perfectly appropriate. I was trying to use food very, very sparingly, and that the use of food would lead to greater distraction from my dog to food in the environment. So dogs that I food trained would be scavengers in restaurants and so on and so forth. So for me, there was a bit of a journey involved in, to take me from where I began to where I am now. Today I do use food. Today I don't use a check collar. And around the world, it is becoming more and more common for guide dog schools to be using more food, and in fact to be using clicker. Has anybody in the room, and again I'll just ask for a show of hands, has anybody in the room ever been instructed at any stage not to use food with your dog?
Yes.
Not to use food with your dog?
Not with the guard dog, but with the other dog.
No, with your guard dog. Yeah, so we've got a few hands.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny for me because I was talking to a client, a wonderful woman who's been using dogs for 35 years. She was sitting in my office with her fifth or sixth dog, and we were talking about the science of training, the use of food, and she was telling me, no, no, don't use food. And I was kind of reflecting on that, and I was saying, well, you know, I've changed, and by the way, don't you remember I was the one who told you not to use food? So that's kind of an interesting experience. But again, I'm not here to tell everybody they should use food. And nor am I here to give training advice to people, because all dogs are different, all dogs' situations are different, all of your needs are different, and my suggestion would be to consult with your school or your instructor of choice. The frequent misconception about the use of food in training is that we're bribing the dog to do something. The real power of the use of food, positive reinforcement, is going when it is used to inform the dog that he has made the right choice. So it's not to get the behaviour, it's to tell the dog that he chose the right behaviour, and that's very, very powerful. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Over my 30 years, I've had a really wonderful life with guide dogs, and it's taken me to I think 7 different countries in the world where I've worked. I'm going to kind of quickly list them, because not because I just want to show off my passport with its stamps, but the opportunity that's given me to come up against very many different styles of training and very many different philosophies about how we handle dogs. So, yeah, my first placement outside Australia was in Israel, a very newly formed school, which is now a very significant player. I spent a little bit of time in Eastern Europe, in Hungary, training dogs, a little bit of time in Croatia, training dogs, a little bit of time in Bosnia, training guide dogs, all guide dog related. A very, very short time in Austria. Any Austrians here? That's kind of good, because that was kind of like the least favourite country that I had.
I took my dog there.
Why was that? Why was that?
Well, if I can sort of divert for a moment, I used to stay while I was working in Austria in a little pension, and I'm generally kind of like wanting to have a pretty pleasant time, and I stayed in this little pension countless times, and the only words I could extract from the management were, do you want cheese or worst with your breakfast? No matter how much I tried to engage these people in conversation or frequency, a little bit of humour even, just wasn't happening. No, it was, do you want cheese or sausage with your breakfast? I was consistently cheese, and after staying there, you know, endless nights, they still needed to ask the question. Also spent a lot of time working in Germany, where I established a school of my own, and that was also a very interesting experience. And I did that under, as I mentioned earlier, an NDIS-like model. In Germany, the funding for guide dogs comes through a nationally underpinned insurance scheme.
What part of Germany?
At various times in near Munich, but later on just...
Oh, you're the best here.
Well, I'm not sure. I moved from there to a place called Egidienburg, which was the birthplace of Konrad Adenauer, who's a famous person in Germany and on the Rhine. A very, very, very beautiful part of the Rhine, known as the Romantic Straße.
Baden-Württemberg?
Yes, I'm
not there.
So I established a little school there, and a boutique school, as many schools are in Germany. In fact, at any one time in Germany, it's a much bigger country than ours, with a much bigger population, but the count of guide dog schools is somewhere between 50 and 100.
A lot of choice out there, and a lot of boutique players like my own. A
lot of shepherds too.
A lot of shepherds and a lot of dodgy operators, but some really good ones too. The big thing for me was that I just came across a lot of different styles, a lot of different people, and for me it's been a journey of learning, and I'm going to confess something, and that is I've learned more about dog behaviour in the last 5 years than I learned in my first 25. And I should be, in a way, ashamed of that, but I'm not. It is what it is. But it's been a fabulous journey these last 5 years as I've started to learn more about the science of training and learn ways to apply that in my day-to-day work. So just coming to clicker training now, we're going to talk about the clicker, but I'm going to talk 60 seconds on clicker and then bin the clicker, because it's the science of learning that underpins the value of clicker training. It's not the clicker itself. So just to get another show of hands, how many people in this room know of or have had experience with clicker training? Yeah, that's not too bad. So we've got probably about 10 people who know what a clicker is or have had some experience. I'm going to pass around the clicker in a minute so people can have a bit of a look and so actually understand what this thing is. However, it's not important. It's not the device that makes the learning possible. So my clicker training experience, as I say, probably began about 10 years ago when I first came up against it. I saw it on a YouTube video, a few people using it, and I thought, oh, that was kind of interesting. But I couldn't see the application in my work. 7 or 8 years ago, I was kind of fortunate enough to spend a week with a woman by the name of Mary Ray. Now, I don't know if any of you have heard of Mary Ray, but Mary Ray is a trainer, a world-famous trainer in dog sport. Dog sport sometimes goes by the label of doggy dancing. So they train very, very complex behaviours for their dogs, and I mean very, very complex behaviours that they then set to music, and they dance with their partner. Highly complex behaviours. That was the thing that really impressed me. So I was very lucky to spend a week with Mary Ray in Queensland, learning about clicker training. And she did some things that really astounded me. They're things that I couldn't do. Some of those things were things I didn't want to do too. But I'll give you an example. She had a toy dog. I can't remember the breed. And she had a toy pram. And she put the pram in a ring full of people, so it was a circle of people, all with dogs, mind you, and sitting around in a circle. And the task was to get this little dog to go over to the pram, grab hold of the handle, and walk the pram around in a circle. Now I'm kind of like, oh yeah, I could do that, no problem. Give me about 1 million years and I can train a dog to do that. She did it with clicker training in under 5 minutes. The dog had never seen a pram before, and within 5 minutes, Mary Ray had taught this dog go to the pram and grab it by the handle, not by the wheel, not by any dangly bits, by the handle, and walk backwards, towing around this circle. Fabulous. How did she do that? I could see the animal learning. I was excited by that. I could see the effect of her training in the way the dog behaved instantaneously. So I got excited. And I started to apply a little bit in my guide dog training, trying to work out how I could apply this technology, if you like, into my work. And quite frankly, I stuffed it up. I got all this other stuff that I didn't want. So instead of my dog standing straight at the curb, he'd be facing 45 degrees to the right, and I'd ask him to find a pole, and he found the pole, all right, but I was just getting towed along in the background, my feet virtually off the ground. So I got all this, junk behaviour, if you like, that wasn't helpful to me. So, bin the clicker, no good. But every now and again I'd pull it out and start to experiment. I found ways to overcome some of the issues that were arising for me. Later on, I made contact with Guide Dogs for the Blind in the United States. It's a school that produces, they have two campuses, and they produce many hundreds of guide dogs a year. And their director of research and development is a woman by the name of Michelle Couliot. And Michelle is a very interesting woman. She'd be in her late 50s now. She, at one stage, was promoted as a possible Olympic equestrian rider. And from the horse world, she crossed over to the dog world and spent a great deal of time, her entire career, working with Guide Dogs for the Blind. Another interesting little sidelight to that story is she was the first female working in the industry in the United States. And in fact, she'd applied to many, many guide dog schools, of which there are quite a few in the United States, and received letters in reply, I'm sorry, this work is too hard and too difficult for women to do. She actually has one of those letters framed on the wall. Michelle is an absolutely fabulous person, totally committed to what she does. She has a modest scientific background, something which I don't, so I'm going to be an imposter up here today. But she did a lot of work in terms of developing a clicker program for training guide dogs at Guide Dogs for the Blind in the United States. Now, the impact of that was quite significant. These are the things they are going to claim. One, they train the dogs in half the time. B, consumers, clients, when they get the dog, have shorter programs and reach higher levels of performance with the dog. Three, they have greater success rates with dogs. And four, the clients who use these dogs express greater levels of satisfaction in the dog's overall performance. I will add at this point that some of that clicker training cascades into the actual program that the guide dog user receives. Dog guide user receives at ClickMe.
I did.
Yeah. It has to be followed with a significant reward at $20. But thanks. Now I've lost my train of thought, but nonetheless, Michelle and her team training, first of all, small groups of dogs in an experimental way, have developed a system where their whole program is based around clicker training. And they have fabulous results, and I visited them and learned from them, and seen the results for myself, and that was a very significant thing for me in terms of developing my skills. The fun's over, guys. So if you kind of think that the rest of the presentation is kind of lighthearted, it isn't. Now we get sort of into some serious stuff. And you might find that I start to repeat myself quite frequently, and that's not actually to help you understand me, that's more to help me understand me. Alongside my developing interest in clicker training, I started to come across these terms like the science of training, the learning theory. Wow, what was that? Didn't get taught a lot of that when I was learning how to train dogs. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about that. Training is an activity that we do. Hopefully learning is what occurs as a result of that activity. When we focus on learning as opposed to training, we're more mindful of how effective it is, how fair it is, and how kind it is to the animal involved in that process. Remember that the animal is not the volunteer in this transaction. The science of learning is actually having a really huge impact across a wide range of animal handling in our society. And it's driven by expectations of high levels of performance. We see that with assistance dogs. We see that with detection dogs. We see that with service dogs of all descriptions. But it's also driven by a need to ensure that we have good welfare outcomes for the animals that are alongside us. Clicker training, or facsimiles of, if you like, are used to train dolphins to do trips at SeaWorld. They're trained, they're used to train dolphins to swim out from a Navy vessel 4 hours away from the boat to detect mines, return and indicate where those mines are. They're used to train assistance dogs. Clicker training is also used a great deal, and there's a growing trend here, in the training of zoo animals and other captive animals. And I just want to give you an example of what that can lead to. There's a fabulous video that I like to show people, but I'll explain what occurs in this video. It's a gibbon, and they want to do a TB test on this gibbon, and that involves using a syringe with a needle, inserting it into the dog's arm, drawing up some blood, and that procedure is going to take somewhere, 30 to 45 seconds. What did they used to do 30 to 40 years ago in order to draw blood from a gibbon? Exactly. Probably dart the poor bloody thing. Or, if it was small enough, well, let's just, stacks on the mill and restrain the animal while we do this procedure. Today, there are gibbons and other animals. We are talking any animal here that will put their arm on the table voluntarily and hold it still while the vet nurse shaves the arm, inserts the needle, draws the blood, and completes the task. And that is a fabulous example of a better welfare outcome from the animal. But think about the humans involved there too. It's a much better outcome for them as well, because they don't have to do all this nasty stuff and all this dangerous stuff. This applies, and I've seen it applied, to cleaning the teeth of a large cat. And I don't mean my domestic cat at home. So a tiger opening its mouth and offering, please brush my teeth, go ahead, I like it. That's not what we would have done 20 or 30 years ago. So the science of training and the use of clickers or other things, and it could be a clicker, it could be a whistle, it could be a bell, any kind of unique sound, can be used in order to train these really complex behaviours that lead to better outcomes, not only for the animal, but better outcomes for us as well. So I did say I was going to get kind of technical and boring. But before we do that, just for those who haven't seen Clicker before, I was going to sort of send one round, but everyone will go Clicker crazy. And there's been times when I've gone Clicker crazy too, so it's a pretty common thing. But I will make them available for those people who just want to see what it is after the presentation. But I want to conduct a little experiment now. Does everybody in the room mind if I do a very little experiment with your dogs?
No.
No harm will come to you.
So we'll make a mint if it does.
So all I'm going to do is make a click on the clicker. Now, we might be able to determine if any of the dogs in this room are clicker trained, because they will react quite potentially just to this sound.
No.
Nothing happened.
There's a door now.
Right. So. Yeah. And the truth of it is that many of the dogs in here probably have never experienced it.
What were you expecting them to do?
Those dogs who had been or had recent. History.
I think that's the key word.
Yes. Yep. That's right. Those dogs who have recent history with a clicker, and that's a very strong depth of reinforcement with history with a clicker, would have stuck their heads up and said, "Where's my beer kettle?" or even more interesting and probably more powerful, would have got to their feet and said, "Training's on. What am I going to learn today?" And that's again a very powerful byproduct of using this technology. Animals want to engage in this process.
So, Paul, I just got a question around that. So what if everyone in this room did have their dogs trained with a clicker, and we all click. So we're all clicking along.
No, you wouldn't need to click.
Wouldn't need to.
But if your dog... I'm going to get into the really dry part of this presentation, which goes on for about 500 pages.
Is it PowerPoint?
No. As I said, I didn't prepare that well, so I'm not actually sure if it takes 15 minutes to get through this stuff or 15 hours and 30 minutes. So we'll just have to see how it goes. This is dry, but the important thing about clicker training is the underpinning science. So we're just going to have a little bit of a talk about that. So what is learning? That's we need to actually arrive at a definition of what learning is, and in the scientific community, the definition looks like this. Learning is a relatively permanent change in the behaviour of the animal that occurs as a result of experience. We're going to go on and talk more in depth about a number of those things, but I'll just repeat it. Learning is a relatively permanent change in behaviour that occurs as a result of experience. Key word there is behaviours. And clicker trainers and whistle trainers and people who use this science of training to underpin their activities often refer to behaviours. And that's everything that your dog does. Everything that you do. Everything that the lizard does. Everything that your cat does. It's just what's happening. What the animal's doing at that time.
Except the same as blowing a whistle that I use to get an MP.
It could be. Well, you'll make the connection yourself on whether you're using the whistle in this way. So in clicker training terms, clicker trainers will often talk about, I'm not teaching my dog to find a seat, I'm working on the behaviour, touch nose to seat, rather than I'm teaching the dog to find a seat. Or I'm working on reducing the behaviour lunging when my dog sees another dog. So instead of working on dog distraction, we're actually targeting what is it about dog distraction that's actually cracking us off. So, I keep threatening to get really dry, and now I am. When we talk about learning or conditioning, there's actually two types. There's more, but there's two types that we're going to focus on today. One is called classical conditioning, and the other one is called operant conditioning.
What's the second one?
Operant conditioning. And when I use conditioning, that could be learning, training, whatever word, insert your favourite word. I'd also like to discuss a couple of other concepts, one of which is reinforcement, another one is punishment. Shaping, schedules of reinforcement, and look at how they apply to training and learning. So, as I've mentioned, I'm no scientist, so you've got to forgive me my mistakes. As I said, I'm a learner, but I found this information really, really valuable, and it's where I have to focus my studies, because it empowers me more and more to get really good results from dogs, and actually helps me get really good results in my interactions with people as well. And you'll be able to work out from the presentation how that might be so. Yeah, the subject learning theory is fascinating to me, and the number of people have liked it at the end of the presentation will indicate how fascinating it is to you. But my belief, my fundamental belief, is that when we use the science of learning to underpin our training activities, we are doing the right thing. Also, at the end of the presentation, you might also understand why I have changed over time. Because the same processes of learning have been working on me as well. There's two types of behaviours, and one of them is what we've learned to do because it works, and there's other types of behaviour which are reflexive. So when I tie my shoelaces, that's a learned behaviour. None of you were born knowing how to tie your shoelaces, but it works because our shoes don't fall off, so we keep doing it. When I bump into the branch of a tree and I blink, that's not something I've learned. I was born with that as a reflexive behaviour. So there are these two types of behaviour, those we learn and those that are completely reflexive. classical conditioning, that first of classical and operant conditioning or training, is largely concerned with behaviours that are involuntary. They're reflexive, they're automatic. Classical conditioning. This type of conditioning or learning was discovered and made famous by a guy called Ivan Pavlov. And you've probably all heard of him, Pavlov and his dogs. And I'm getting dry here, it's going to get worse. What Pavlov discovered is that a neutral stimulus, that is the sound of a ringing bell, which had no meaning to a dog, when paired or presented with an unconditioned stimulus, that's something that the animal instinctively enjoys, in this case food for the dog, the bell eventually began to elicit exactly the same behaviour or response from the dog as the food did. In essence, give the dog food, he salivates. Pavlov found that you can ring the bell and the dog will salivate. That's pretty interesting stuff. As I said, Pavlov discovered, and quite by accident, that when he rang the bell, regardless of whether the food was there or not, his dogs were salivating. So, into classical conditioning. Classical conditioning is just learning that one stimulus signals the arrival of another stimulus. The stimulus, we talked about a bell, but it could be actually anything. It could be a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, or a body sensation that any human or animal could perceive. This classical conditioning is often referred to as Pavlovian conditioning because, as I say, Pavlov was the first researcher to study and work with this learning system. So we're going to take a little bit of a closer look at what Pavlov did, and hopefully we'll gain an understanding of what classical conditioning is about by talking about Pavlov's work. So Pavlov was actually a physiologist, and he won a Nobel Prize in 1904, and it wasn't about this discovery of classical conditioning. He was actually interested in dog saliva. He wasn't interested in what made dogs salivate. He was interested in digestive processes. Interestingly, and again a sideline, when he received his 1904 Nobel Prize, the expectation was that he would be talking about digestion, but he was so excited by his discovery of classical conditioning that that's all he talked about, and the audience thought he was completely mad. So in Pavlov's studies of the digestive processes of dogs, the dogs were strapped into harnesses. This is going back to early 20th century. Dogs were strapped into the harnesses, had tubes inserted in their cheeks to measure salivation, which is the initial step in digestive processes. All very lovely stuff. I'll come to some of the more lovely stuff later on.
Dogs in space.
Oh, well, and it gets worse than that. But Pavlov, he cleverly, I'm not so sure cleverly, but found a way to divert that saliva from the dog's mouth so that it was excreted through the dog's cheek. In order to stimulate the dog to salivate, meat powder was presented to the dog, and then the amount of saliva was measured. His discovery was accidental. What he noticed was that his dogs were starting to salivate before the meat powder was even put in their mouths. For example, even the lab attendants walking into the room began to elicit salivation in the dogs. So Pavlov wanted to know why that was, because it was kind of mucking up his experiments a bit, and this became the focus of his research for the rest of his career. So, in order to understand classical conditioning a little bit better, let's just consider why dogs salivate when the meat powder was put in their mouth. Well, what we know is that that's just a reflex, isn't it? That you're born with this capacity, which applies to us too, when we put dogs... When we put salivate... I've travelled in Vietnam, but I haven't actually lived there. So it's a reflexive response to salivate. Dogs do it, I do it, you do it, As I say, this is a reflex. The reflex is the reflexive stimulus, which is food in the mouth, that elicits the automatic response, or salivation, is referred to as the unconditioned stimulus. The response is automatically elicited by the stimulus, which in this case is food. The key word is unconditioned. This means no learning was necessary for this food to elicit this response. It's naturally occurring. So let's now just move on from that to examine how reflexes are used to achieve conditioning. Pavlov began with the neutral stimulus, the bell, a stimulus that does not naturally elicit the behaviour or conditioned response, which is salivation. He used various neutral stimuli, such as tone generated by a tuning fork, a light, a touch on the leg, and the bell, of course, in his conditioning research. Before conditioning, his dogs did not automatically salivate to these stimuli. They salivated to the meat, but they didn't salivate to the bell. They had to learn or be conditioned to do this. To achieve this conditioning, the neutral stimulus, such as the bell, that has no meaning to the animal, is presented just before the unconditioned stimulus is presented, i.e. the food. So, bell, food. Not food, bell, bell, food. Just before, what does that mean? It could be a few seconds, but optimally, the time interval between the onsets of the two stimuli is very brief. Only a half second to 1 second is what research suggests is best for this type of conditioning. So once the conditioning has occurred, and we know that it's occurred when the dog starts to salivate to the sound of the bell, at that point, the neutral stimulus, the bell, is referred to as the conditioned stimulus. The dog has been conditioned to salivate to the sound of the bell. The previously neutral stimulus, the bell, comes to elicit a new response after repeated pairings with the meat powder. The learned response, or salivation, to the conditioned stimulus is called conditioned response. The conditioned response, salivation, is a preparatory response for the impending meat powder for the dog. Now, that was, I told you it was dry.
It was conditioned stimuli, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I just want to just touch now on the relationship of the timing again. The timing of the relationship between the bell and the delivery of the food is a critical factor in classical conditioning. The conditioned stimulus, or the bell, must be presented just before the stimulus that makes the dog respond. Because the conditioning involves learning that this stimulus is a reliable predictor for the arrival of the meat powder. Does that make sense? So the dog needs to learn that when the bell rings, it is a certainty that meat powder is on the way. And that's classical conditioning. So I'll just tell you another little interesting story about classical conditioning. And going back in history, there was some pretty weird people working in the behavioural sciences. And one of those was a guy called John Watson, who was an American psychologist in the early part of the 20th century. And he was considered the founder of behavioural psychology. He was really impressed with Pavlov's work on conditioning and the potential it had to make psychology an objective science of behaviour. To examine the role of conditioning in human emotional responses such as fear, Watson and his delightful researcher assistant Rosalie Rayner conducted a study on an 11-month-old infant called Albert. This is known as the Little Albert Study. As a neutral stimulus, that is, something that the child, that Albert, wouldn't react to, the researchers used a little white laboratory rat. Albert wasn't afraid of that rat at all. In fact, when he saw the rat before the conditioning, He would move towards it and touch it, he wanted to play with it, he really wanted to interact with it. So the reflex that Watson and his partner Rayner used to elicit a response. Well, little Albert, our 11-month-old child, was looking at the white rat. Mr. Watson snuck up behind him with an iron bar and a hammer and clanged them together. So Albert's reflexive response was fear avoidance, of course. Scared the absolute bejesus out of the poor kid. What Watson and Rayner did then was continue to present the white laboratory rat to little Albert, and every time Albert looked at the white rat, he'd hear that smash and crash behind him and get the scare of his life. So what they did was pair the sight of the rat, the neutral stimulus, with an unexpected loud noise, which would lead to fear. After the conditioning trials, all they had to do was present the laboratory rat for young Albert to go into a fear and avoidance response. No further banging of the metal behind his head was required. He just saw the rat, and he reliably predicted in his mind, really crazy things are going to happen to me now. I'm scared. It took only 7 clangs behind his head for him to start thinking of the rat as really bad news. I guess we probably all agree that that kind of study is not very ethical, and we probably wouldn't be allowed to do such studies today. However, given that they were done, we can learn from them. So I'm just going to take questions later because I've got sort of 500 pages, but store it up and don't make it too complicated if that's the only funnily enough, at the time of the experiment, Watson was really heavily criticised for this experiment, but he wasn't criticised for what he was doing to the child. He was criticised by animal rights activists.
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah, the Rat Protection Society.
Oh.
Yeah. Look, it's really important to now just consider that this classical conditioning, it's not only involved in conditioning negative emotional responses, such as the fear that little Albert had, but also used to develop positive emotional responses to stimuli, such as the pleasure that the dogs would have been feeling when they heard the bell and knew good things were going to happen. Again, just as an aside, Mr. Watson was actually forced to leave academic life because he started to become more interested in Rosalie, his assistant, than his research. He was sort of trying out of the academic world. But he did turn his talents to advertising, and he pioneered the use of these same principles in the advertising we see today, such as pairing sports stars and so on with products, which is, again, about classically conditioning us to feel good about products. So he continued his evil long beyond his studies with little Albert. So there's too dry so far, guys?
No,
we could divert, we could go on to some other topic and go back to my 30-year career. Okay, so there's a few general learning processes that I just want to cover off on. We've seen how classical conditioning works. A new learned response is elicited by the conditioned stimulus in preparation for the arrival of the unconditioned stimulus. Don't worry if you don't get this. I don't get it either.
What was that last bit?
No complex questions. Asking me what I just said is a complex question.
Oh, okay. We'll say it in German then.
This response, or learning, we sometimes refer to as acquisition. So that's just the academic word for learning new behaviours. They talk about acquiring new behaviours. So now we'll just go on to another little interesting thing. What do you think would happen to young Albert if we continued to present the rat that he originally liked and we didn't ever again banging the two bits of metal behind his head.
It needs therapy, I think.
It ends up hating rats.
He'd like the rat eventually again.
Correct. And that's what they discovered. That after a period of time, without that punishing effect, effectively, of that two bits of metal being banged together, the conditioning disappeared. This is called extinction. So when we acquire, when we learn a new behaviour, it's called acquisition. When we get rid of a behaviour, we call that extinction. And we do that all the time with our dogs. We do an extinction process when we're removing an undesirable behaviour with our dogs. There is another interesting thing that happens in that process, and that is, if you do extinguish a previous behaviour that's undesirable, but you have a break, and then you come back to the animal, it might have another go at that undesirable behaviour, but it'll be for a short time. And it'll disappear again quite quickly. And that's known as spontaneous recovery. But it still tells you, and it's still okay, because the behaviour is on the way to being removed from the repertoire of the dogs. For me, that was a really interesting thing as a trainer.
Well, spontaneous recovery again?
Spontaneous recovery.
Yeah.
When you go back and try run another trial with the animal, the previously learned behaviour might pop just for a moment.
Right.
But just might start doing what it might. You've taught it not to jump up on you.
Yep.
But you go back into the room 10 minutes later and it starts jumping up on you again.
Yep.
But it doesn't do that for very long.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that's again, what's sometimes referred to as the learning curve. As a trainer, that was really valuable for me to understand that, because whenever my dogs made mistakes, I could actually look at them and understand whether or not it's actually part of the learning process, which means it's okay, this mistake is not a big deal, he's still learning, or whether I wasn't achieving the result I wanted. This enabled me to actually deal kindly with my dogs and not immediately drop into a correction. It really has implications in the second thing that I'm going to talk about, which is operant conditioning. And that suggests that when we change the context, and for all of you guys today, when you arrived here, you changed the context of the world for your dogs, so their behaviour changes. Some of them might have been a little bit more difficult to manage, some of them might have been a little bit more withdrawn than normal, but the context can lead to changes in behaviour. And that really has implications in looking at the learning curve. Classical conditioning is really important to us. And consider the growth of young puppies. They're out in the environment, they don't understand the nature of the environment around them. So we are trying to pair all of those nasty things out there in the world, trains going past, planes going overhead, rubbish trucks making really loud noises, with really nice things. So that the dog is classically conditioned to feel good in the presence of those things. Now, even if you're doing nothing, these conditioning processes are still going on. Now we come to clicker training, only for a moment. In clicker training, we begin with classical conditioning. And the way we do that is quite simple. We make the sound with the clicker, click, we give the dog a piece of food. After a short number of trials, sometimes 6, maybe 15, but a very short period of time, in the dog's mind, the clicker becomes a reliable, the message that the clicker suggests to the dog is, a nice little treat is on its way to me. And the value of the clicker, the power of the clicker, is derived through that. The clicker must tell the dog that good things are on the way. So that bit of classically conditioning the dog to a clicker takes a very, very short period of time to do. How are we going for time, by the way? As I put it, my mic on 13 hours. 12:26. Wow.
So you've got half an hour.
Better get busy. operant condition. So let's start talking about operant condition. So I'm going to work a little bit faster now. We describe classical conditioning or learning by association between stimuli in our environment. Operant conditioning is learning about how behaviours have consequences. So it's about what you do and what occurs as a result of what you do. So we can say pretty simply that behaviours that are reinforced, that is, lead to satisfying consequences, will occur more often, they'll be strengthened, and behaviours that are punished or lead to unsatisfying consequences for the animal will be weakened. The behaviour that is reinforced or punished is referred to as the operant process because the animal is operating on the environment at the time. We are constantly operating on our environment and learning from the consequences of our behaviour. For example, in meeting someone who you'd like to date, your behaviour, the way you talk and the way you act, will either lead to a satisfying consequence, that is a date, or an unsatisfying consequence. If it's a satisfying consequence, you'll continue to act the way that you did. If it was an unsatisfying consequence, you'll ultimately change your behaviour. Now, research on how we learn by association and learn about consequences began around the beginning of the 20th century also. A guy by the name of Thorndike was studying the ability of cats and other animals to learn about puzzle boxes. In these puzzle boxes, there was usually only one way to get out. Put the cat in, there's only one way to get out, okay? And that was by pressing a lever. So he put these hungry cats in these boxes. On the other side of the box, the door, he put some food. And then Mr. Thorndike did record how long it took the cat to work out that pressing the lever led to its release to get to the food. What he found was it might take a little while for the cat to initially press the lever to get out to get to the food, but as he kept putting the cat back in the box, the cat started to get much, much faster at pressing that lever. So the cat was learning the consequences of pressing that lever means I get out to the food. So that is known as operant conditioning.
And what was his name?
Thorndike. Thorndike actually developed what he called the law of effect. Any behaviour that results in satisfying consequence tends to be repeated. Any behaviour that results in an unsatisfying consequence tends not to be repeated. Actually, he didn't win a Nobel Prize, but it sort of sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? No, I sort of wish I'd been the first one to come up with that sort of fairly obvious statement. In the 1930s, another very important person in terms of behaviour came along, and his name was Skinner. And he was the most influential of all these behaviourists. And he redefined the law in a little bit more objective terms and started a much more scientific examination of how we learn through this process of operant conditioning. So let's just get to, I'm just going to skip over a little bit here. We talked about reinforcement and punishment. So reinforcement would lead to the behaviour occurring more frequently. Punishment would lead to the behaviour occurring less frequently. So let's just take that cat for an example. The reward for pressing the lever is to get out and eat. So the cat learns, press the lever more often, more quickly. If we put an electric current through the lever, the cat would learn very quickly, don't touch the lever. So the punishment would reduce the behaviour, push the lever. Let's just take a dog example for one moment. If you operantly condition your dog to sit by offering her a food treat each time she sat, the food treat would be known as the reinforcer. The process of increasing the dog's sitting behaviour by using this reinforcement would be called exactly that, reinforcement. In the same way, if you condition this dog to stop jumping on you by spraying it in its face with water each time she did so, the spraying would be the punisher and the process of decreasing your dog's jumping behaviour by using this punisher would be called punishment. So now we kind of understand, which we kind of logically did anyway, how we define reinforcement and punishment. And we also need to just, and if it's dry so far, this is where it gets really dry and really confusing and really quite challenging. There are a couple of other additional distinctions I want to make. Reinforcement and punishment can be either positive or negative.
Okay.
And that creates four new terms. So let's just go through those four terms, and they are positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, and negative punishment. Positive and negative reinforcement and punishment. To understand these terms, we first have to understand that positive and negative do not have their normal meanings in this context. The word positive effectively means add something. The word negative means take something away. There's also two types of stimulus that we could provide to the dog. One is an attractive stimulus and one is an aversive stimulus. So an attractive stimulus could be something the animal finds pleasant, such as food or a cat. An aversive stimulus would be a correction, for instance. For us, food, money, good grades in an exam are examples of positive stimuluses or attractive stimuluses for us, but a strong electric shock, failure in an exam, or being ill are examples of aversives. So in the context of reinforcement, we just want to talk a little bit about positive and negative reinforcement. In positive reinforcement, something attractive is presented. In positive punishment, an aversive stimulus is applied. So this is really counterintuitive, isn't it? I correct my dog. That is actually positive punishment. Where we logically want to think of that as negative, but it's actually called positive punishment because we're adding something, a leash correction. Another example of positive punishment would be spanking a child and obeying the rules. In negative reinforcement and negative punishment, something is taken away. Remember, negative is we take something away. So that could mean when we push down on the back of our dog, which is uncomfortable for the dog, and then he sits, the aversive has been removed. He moves into comfort from discomfort.
That's negative reinforcement. Oh, no, negative, hang on, negative.
That's negative reinforcement.
Reinforcement, okay.
In negative punishment, we remove the opportunity for reward. So in a dog training example, that might be the dog jumps up on you and he considers that really good fun. You turn your back and fold your arms and remove the opportunity for him to have fun. Okay, so I'm sort of trying to skip through a few pages because we did consume a bit of time. What's important? What's really important about this? We only know if something has been a reinforcer or a punisher if the behaviour keeps occurring or the behaviour goes away. So whether or not it has actually worked has to be measured by increase in behaviour or decrease in behaviour. Sorry, skip over that one. Very, very quickly, there are also two types of reinforcer. One is known as a primary, one is known as a secondary reinforcer. Primary reinforcers are things that you're born liking. So for a dog, he's born liking food. So it's known as a primary reinforcer. He's not born necessarily enjoying your praise. He has to learn to value your praise. So this is referred to as a secondary reinforcer. So actually we're not just doing that. Operant condition. A type of conditioning in which an individual's behaviour is modified by consequence. It's called operant because the learner must operate on its environment to produce the good or bad consequences. The dog sits. It's reinforced with reinforcers such as food, stroking, or praise, so it continues to offer that behaviour. In operant conditioning, the learner forms an association between the response and its consequences. The consequences are dependent on whether the response is good or bad. In operant conditioning, we can also add a stimulus that signals to the learner that a response at this time is likely to be reinforced. So if an example of that is adding cue to a behaviour in your dog. So we say sit to the dog, he gets food, he sits naturally. We say sit to the dog and he gets food, or he gets praise. If he sits over in the corner where you're not watching, he gets neither of those things. It's just a naturally occurring behaviour. It doesn't become associated with the sit command. An example of conditioning a negative response would be when we say no, and that comes to reliably predict that the dog's going to get a leash correction. That would be a situation where we're likely to get a decrease in behaviour. So to give you a couple of examples of that, depending on your experience and whether or not who brings you at home, here is an example of the sort of learning that might have occurred to you. When the phone rings, which is kind of a green light for a possible reward, you answer the phone, that's your behaviour, and you have an enjoyable chat with your friend. So that's the consequence, the reinforcer. So you learn, phone rings, could be my friend, I'm going to answer it. The flip side of that could be that the phone rings, which becomes a green light for the possibility of punishment, because when you answer, it's an insurance salesman from the National Australia Bank.
Or a telemarker asking for money.
Absolutely. Probably from Guide Dogs Victoria. What we call this kind of green light, if you like, is called a discriminative stimulus. In our case, we use them. Our discriminative stimulus is our commands. We say to the dog, find a seat. That's a green light for that behaviour. The dog goes to the seat. We give them a reward of one type or another. It's important, that green light for the behaviour, because we don't want just wanting to be taking us to this every seat in the place, because there is a possibility of gaining a reward. Okay, so modern trainers focus upon the use of positive reinforcement in their training.
So if they find the seat when you don't want them to and you say no, that's the, what's that called?
You don't need to say no. Just don't reward the behaviour and the behaviour will go away.
Yeah. But what's that called? Is that called like a negative reinforcer or something?
Yes, if the dog associates the no command with something bad happening to it.
Okay,
so clicker trainers are focused on using positive reinforcement as their tool of choice when they're training their dogs. And that's a really important distinction to make. That's what clicker trainers are about. They're about the use of positive reinforcement. So just to get another quick sort of knowledge check, punishment makes the behaviour less likely to occur again. Reinforcement makes the behaviour more likely to occur again. We actually use punishment quite widely in learning, but there is some research around this, and punishment can lead to negative effects. And some of those are development of unwanted fears, unwanted behaviours that reappear in the absence of punishment. In some cases, learners can become aggressive towards their trainer. And quite frequently, unwanted behaviours are just replaced by other unwanted behaviours. We talked briefly about primary reinforcers. They are things that we're born liking, such as cheese or biscuits, in the case of dogs, kibble or meat. And we also just talked briefly about secondary reinforcers. These are things that we learn over time are good for us. And when I say good boy or good girl to my dog, but he's associating with that with nice outcomes, like I pair that with a piece of food or a pat, that becomes reinforcing to him over time. It's a secondary reinforcer because he had to learn. Okay. There's a few assumptions that we do make. And one of those is just because we think we're reinforcing a behaviour doesn't necessarily mean that we are. One type of reinforcer might work for one dog, one type might work for another, and even the situation might actually change that. Importantly in reinforcement, and you'd all know this, is that praise, food reward, reinforcement of any sort must be delivered immediately or as soon after the behaviour as possible. How are we going for time?
You got 15 minutes.
Whoa! So, quick knowledge check again. A behaviour followed by a reinforcer, a just quick show of hands. If a behaviour is followed by a reinforcer, it's more likely to happen again?
Yep.
Less likely to happen again? Good. Applying a leash correction, trick question, is it positive punishment or negative punishment? Hands up for positive punishment. Yes. Very good. Because we added something.
Yeah.
Food. Is it a primary or secondary reinforcer?
Primary.
Yes. Praise. Primary or secondary reinforcer?
Secondary.
Yes. Good. You learn fast and let me hear. When should a reinforcer be delivered?
Immediately.
Not the day after?
No.
Perfect.
I learnt that the hard way.
So, in clicker training, which has been, the clicker has been classically conditioned to the dog, it reliably informs the dog food's on the way. When we click, when the dog is doing something, the dog is likely to repeat that behaviour in order to gain that reward. The dog knows that the consequences are good, so he wants to repeat that behaviour. Okay. I'm going to have to talk really, really quickly about something called shaping, because shaping is the other really important factor about clicker training. And I'm going to do it by example, which I would have gone into later, but it'll explain how it works. Shaping is essentially the rewarding of successive approximations of the target behaviour. So it means we can actually reward the animal as if it completed the behaviour, even if it's only got the path right. So this keeps the animal engaged and wanting to learn the behaviour. So I'm going to give you an example of what shaping looks like. My dog is already classically conditioned to expect food when he hears the clicker. I've tied a piece of rope to the door handle and I want to teach him to open the door. I bring him into the room. He looks around. As his head passes by the door, which is in the distance, I click him and reward him. Because he's a clicker-trained dog, he knows, I'm going to repeat that. I'm going to do that. That's where he wants me to look. I'm looking there. I don't click him for that. And he thinks, well, I thought I did the right thing. I'll take one step towards it. Click. Ah, he gets his reward. Immediately, he locks back onto the target. Off he goes, two or three steps. I click it. Very, very soon, he's at the door. He might touch the door at any point, but very soon, by accident, he's going to touch the bit of rope. Click. He's immediately going to target that piece of rope. Then I'm going to wait to click him when he uses his teeth to touch the rope, rather than his lips. And then I'm going to ask him to, or wait for him to offer more behaviour, which might be grabbing the rope and eventually pulling the rope and so on and so forth. Does that explain, you know, I wanted to spend a lot more time on shaping, but does that explain how I've kept the dog engaged and rewarded him all through the behaviour? So he's been a really active learner. And that's really the key here. Right, skip. So back to shaping. The definition of shaping, the reinforcement of successive approximations of the target behaviour. And if you want to know what clicker training is about, that is what clicker training is about. It enables us to reward the dog on the journey to getting it right. Now, very quickly, what happens when we've got that behaviour? Do we have to keep clicking it? Do we have to keep feeding it? No, we don't. In fact, once we've got the target behaviour, we want to stop clicking because the clicker says, try harder, try harder. We want you to shape a behaviour. Once we've got the target behaviour, we might feed the dog for a little while. So he continually gets reinforced. I'm doing the right thing. I'm going to keep doing that. And then another little learning process, which I really wanted to spend more time on, but I'm not going to have time, is what we call thinning the schedule. And this is really interesting. If I then just start feeding him for every second or third time he does that behaviour for me, very early on in the process, he'll get a little bit frustrated. But as he learns that at some point, if I keep doing this, I'll get rewarded, he actually will start to do it even more strongly than if I rewarded him every time. In the case of a rat pressing the lever in one of those Skinner boxes to get, when he presses the lever, he gets a little bit of food. In the Skinner box, as you thin the schedule, you can ultimately get the animal pressing the lever 10,000 times for one piece of kibble. But it's important to thin the schedule very, very slowly. Importantly also, you can introduce secondary reinforcers, such as a pat for the dog. So you're reinforcing that behaviour all the way down the line. So, given that we must be really, really close to time, I'm going to call it quits there and offer this opportunity too. If people want to talk to me about clicker training, I'll be more than happy to go one-on-one with you for many, many hours. But I do hope that...
Can we get a copy of your notes if we want them?
Ooh. what I will do... that's certainly not correct. What underpins clicker training is the application of learning theory. So what I will do is I will gather some appropriate material to some learning materials for people who might want to learn more about learning theory. And I'll post them through the DGHA website or email. Would that meet everybody's name?
Yeah,
cool. Because I want you to learn this stuff. I learn it. Well, you know, I'm learning it, and I'm a better trainer as a consequence.
Okay, so is that
working? Yeah, I just got one quick question.
Ooh. No.
Like,
no.
I had my dog.
Okay, go.
All right,
Greg.
I've had my dog for 7 years.
Yes.
Penny, we can't hear you without a microphone, and there were other people that had questions before you.
Sorry, I thought we were...
So while you're going to the next question, I'll just answer that, because I think what the question was, and that is, can my old dog learn new tricks?
Yeah.
Good. Will clicker training work for my dog, my dog's 7? Absolutely, 100%. No. But I'm also going to suggest that nobody just go out and rush out and buy a clicker and start doing it. It is a precision tool, and it would be very, very advisable for you to work with your local GDMI and explore whether or not they're interested in showing you the use of it. And also, I would add, everyone can use this tool if you learn how to use it properly. Mm.
Actually, what we might do, given that Paul said he's going to be available during the lunch, because we're just coming up to lunchtime now. So if you can talk to Paul during the lunch, he's happy to take your questions. That would be great. As Paul suggested, we've recorded this session. So is this microphone working or not?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so what we're going to do, if you could ask your questions to Paul within the lunch break, that'd be great, given that we're just on 1 o'clock and we're going to need to go through into lunch.
Sorry, Greg, it was part of my strategy to avoid awkward questions. Make sure you run over
to lunch. So anyone with awkward questions, disregard that. Anyone with simple, easy questions, Paul will answer those. But what Paul has offered is some resources in and around his talk today. We've recorded the talk. We're going to have that up on the website and we'll have those resources available connected with that. But what I would like you to do, I've never been in a conference where I've heard a room so quiet and so absorbed as this. Could you please put your hands together for Paul? It was a great presentation.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?